Hunting boots are a critical component of any successful hunt. Whether walking a short distance to your blind or trudging miles through rugged terrain, your feet are carrying the load. Without the right boots, you could give up early and lose out on that trophy just over the ridge. At Midway USA, we make selecting boots for your next hunt easier. With just a few clicks of a mouse, you can decide on what's important, like waterproofing, insulation, size, width, and savings. For just about everything for shooting, hunting, and the outdoors, check out MidwayUSA.com. At Midway USA, we know the AR-15 is one of the most popular rifles in modern American history. Known for its modularity and widespread use, it's often considered essential to any gun collection. The essential things you need to run an AR-15 are usually always in stock during shortages, things like magazines and 5.56 ammo. Whether you're looking to buy a new AR-15 or buy parts for your modern sporting rifle, log on and for just about everything for the outdoors, shop MidwayUSA.com.
Welcome to the Casting Across Fly Fishing Podcast. I'm Matthew of castingacross.com, where I explore the quarry and culture of fly fishing. Before I get into the substance of the podcast, I want to talk about what that means. If you've been listening to the 190 plus episodes of this podcast, or you've been reading the website for the 5 or 6 years that it's been around, then you might know what I mean by quarry and culture. But today's podcast in particular deals with the synthesis or the junction point of these two important topics. So when I talk about the quarry of fly fishing, I'm talking about the fish, because at the end of the day, that's kind of the target. Now, certainly, we don't go fly fishing simply to catch fish. There's more to it than that. As I wrote recently, there's many more efficient and effective ways to get fish at the end of a line or get them into your hand. So the fish matter, whether they be trout or, as we'll talk about today, some other kinds of fish. That is an essential part of fly fishing. It's kind of what brings us together as fly fishers and a fly fishing community and culture. And then there's the culture side of it. And that is everything that goes into it. This wonderful thing that we do, whether it be these long drives up into the mountains or these early mornings out on the beach, whether it be picking out your favorite fly rod, whether it be talking with somebody in a fly shop, whether it be reading a book, listening to a podcast, whatever it might be, there's a lot of stuff that exists on the periphery of that quarry. And today, as I said, is going to be a conversation about kind of the junction of these two items, the quarry and the culture of fly fishing. Because fly fishing is not that typical lithograph or insurance commercial picture of fly fishing. At least it's not anymore. Fly fishing has, over the years, over the decades, garnered a reputation that's well-deserved in some circles of being elitist and being very narrow, of having a very tight orthodoxy. And what I mean by that is that it's tweed jacket, wicker creel, bamboo rod, dry fly, upstream native trout. Right? That is like the most narrow form of orthodoxy. Well, I don't subscribe to that. I love those things. Well, I don't think I ever have fished in tweed or with a wicker creel. I'm not opposed to fishing in tweed. If anyone has some nice tweed, I'll send you my measurements. But that's certainly not fly fishing in total, and it isn't even kind of the majority of what fly fishing is. So that's not the culture. That's part of the culture, but that's not definitional of the culture. But when it comes to the quarry, there's a lot more than trout. A simple scroll on Instagram, and I know that's not a total sample size, but if you go to the search feature and you put fly fishing in, you're going to see a lot of trout, but you're also going to see a lot of other fish. You're going to see all the species of trout in just the United States. You're going to see all the major species of trout. You're going to see a smallmouth bass and largemouth bass and panfish, and you're going to see striped bass and bluefish and larger big game species. You're going to see redfish and snook. You're going to see gar, and you're going to see catfish, and you're going to get into some fish that maybe your grandfather, if he was a fly fisher and he was in that tweed class, he would have just kind of rolled his eyes at the idea of going out and pursuing a carp. Well, the fact of the matter is, I think carp are a great, renovation story. They're a great pretty woman kind of arc in that there was nothing more kind of slimy and undesirable and less fly fishing-y than common carp. And now there's entire books and magazines and podcasts and movements and assortments of flies and gear that is oriented towards catching big carp, because they're fun and they fight hard. And with the catch and release ethos that has permeated the majority of the fly fishing culture, then who cares what the fish tastes like? Who cares what its plate value is? Because at the end of the day, the most important thing, are you having fun pursuing it? And is there some sort of reward once you hook into it? And carp is a great example. They've got soft, fleshy mouths. They're very spooky. And so hooking up with one is a challenge. But at the same time, once you do hook up into it, then you're going to have a blast, particularly on fly tackle. But we're not here to talk about carp today, because actually I'm not a carp expert. And I'm not going to be an expert on the two species of fish that I'm going to be talking about today in this trash fish extravaganza. And maybe this will start a series on trash fish. But I don't believe they're trash fish. I'm only calling them trash fish because that's what I grew up calling them. And that's what some people still refer to them as today. But I think it's something that it's a name, or it's a title of these kind of less desirable or non-traditional species that people who aim for them actually use in a endearing manner. Because I can say for certain that the two species we're talking about today are fish that I really don't, you know, think that they've ruined my day when they're on the end of the line. And so without further ado, let's talk about the first species. And the first species is the chain pickerel. So the chain pickerel is a species that you're probably very familiar with. It is a freshwater fish. It's part of the pike family. And so immediately that should give you really good feelings, because when you think of pike, when you think of these giant prehistoric looking fish, whether they be pike or muskie, there's just something wild about them. Their shape, their head, their mouth, their ferocity on which they not only strike but fight. The fact that they have teeth really brings something to the party that a lot of other fish don't have. So the pickerel is one of the smaller species of this family, of the Esox family. And it could be known in no matter, you know, where you live across the eastern seaboard as grass pike or jack or jackfish or eastern pickerel. But it is the chain pickerel is what it is called. And it's easily identified, and it is well named because it has this chain pattern along its sides. And it also makes it relatively easily distinguishable from when you hook up with a large specimen of a chain pickerel versus when you hook up to a pike. You'd be able to tell a difference because the patterning on the side of the fish. The chain pickerel's distribution is up and down the East Coast. They are found as far west as like the Midwest and even down into Texas, but they're all the way up in Canada, all around to Florida. But in the real northern areas, up into like southern Canada and particularly around the Great Lakes, they are considered invasive. And they occupy the same niche as some of these other esox or these other pike species. And so in worst case scenario, they could be pushing out native species, even the northern pike, which is kind of crazy to think about. But of course, a baby fish is a baby fish. A small fish is a small fry. And any fish that is occupying the same niche, whether it be for food source, for breeding spaces, is going to cause pressure on other species. So again, as is the case with any fish, even our beloved trout, if they're in the wrong place, if they're a non-native species, then they are ultimately problematic. But chain pickerel are a lot of fun. Now, one of their pejorative names is slime dart because they do stink. Yesterday, I actually caught a decent sized one, and my friend was laughing because he said, "You're going to smell like chain pickerel for the rest of the day." And it's true. They do have a little bit of funk going on, but really, at the end of the day, it's no more than most other stinky fish that you're going to catch. You don't know how good we have it with trout when we catch trout. They don't really have a whole lot of smell, but they are a lot of fun. And again, if you're not catching them to keep, then who cares? That being said, I have a good buddy who fishes down in South Carolina, catches them down there, calls them jackfish. He says they're one of the best fish deep fried. Okay, but this is not a cooking a podcast. This is not even a recommendation for keeping or not keeping fish. But they put up a decent fight, to the extent that I would say a chain pickerel of 12 inches is going to fight harder than a trout of 12 inches. You might balk at that, but I'll certainly say this. a chain pickerel of 12 inches is going to fight harder than a stocked trout of 12 inches. Your run-of-the-mill, out-of-the-truck at 8 inches, has a season to grow trout, is not going to fight as hard as a pickerel. And then you get up to that 20-inch mark, and you know, they fight stinking hard, and they're pretty plentiful. Now, a 20-inch bass is going to pull pretty hard, but I've had some 20-inch pickerel where I think, what do I have on the end of this line? And especially when they are in a location where they are well-fed, where they are proportionate, you will find places where they're overpopulated, where the food sources are out of whack, and it's just not a really good ecosystem, where their heads get really big and then they get really, really skinny. Those don't fight super hard. But when they have those kind of traditional pike-like proportions, then they're going to fight really hard. They've got a nice, strong set of shoulders on them, and they have a big, thick tail that they can really move a lot of water. And that is not only going to translate into their ability to fight, but it's also going to turn into some spectacular takes. You think about the traditional, like, Northwoods pike fishing, pulling big lures, or for our purposes, big flies just under the surface under the water or over the top water, whether it be through lily pads or open water, you know, over some sort of underwater structure. And you see these big wakes coming behind them, and you watch this big pike come up and destroy the fly or the lure. Chain pickerel are going to do the same thing, especially big, aggressive, angry chain pickerel. They're going to strike just like that. And it's a lot of fun. It's just a thrill to see that happen. So what do I like to use for flies? Everything. Any kind of streamer is going to work. And I actually really like using a streamer that has a extended body with a hook that is further back. And the reason is not because they're not going to take the head of this fly, but I do like the idea of hooking them in the corner of their mouth and not so much on their lips. I have found that I have frayed more line when that lure is kind of in the front of its mouth, either in the top or the bottom, or kind of on its tongue, for lack of a better term. They actually have teeth on the top of their mouth, the roof of their mouth. So if I have an extended body hook, or I don't do this a lot, particularly for warm water fish that aren't bass with weedless bugs that I throw in for largemouth bass, but I have had success with articulated streamers, not because you need that extra motion, but because it does kind of move that hook back. And generally speaking, those hook shanks and the hooks that you use to tie those flies are going to have a wider gap, which for any fish that is striking hard and moving quickly, you're going to increase your odds for a good solid hookup. So that I found more success with patterns like that, and they can be anything. They can be a clouser, they can be a woolly bugger, they can be a deceiver. I generally like flies that are going to displace a little bit more water. So something like a deceiver is going to be better than a clouser, and even some of those traditional kind of largemouth bass flies or smallmouth bass flies that might have a little bit of a body to them, whether it be with dubbing, probably synthetic dubbing, or even some deer hair, are going to work really well because they're going to displace a lot of that water, and they're going to get those fish looking up and eliciting that predatory instinct. So cast it, and I mean, I've found success in retrieving them quickly. I've found success in retrieving them slowly, but once you get that bump, then keep stripping. I've found that just like a lot of other toothy fish, they're going to stay on the hunt after they've had a little bit of taste and they've missed out on something. They're not going to turn tail and run like a small little trout. They're going to be aggressive, and they're not going to want to miss out on anything. And they will chase it right up to the boat, just like you see with pike. And I think that's a fun way to fish for them, is by a canoe. A canoe on a lily pad covered pond in New England, you're going to have a lot of fun, and your kids are going to have a lot of fun fishing for chain pickerel. My boys absolutely love it because they do put up a big fight, and they look like little dragons. I mean, it's a phenomenal thing. So chain pickerel, a lot of love for them. They're fun. I don't think I've ever eaten one, but they're certainly worth eating if you have a water body that isn't polluted. And I think some of these ponds that I fish that are further up in New Hampshire and in Maine, where I catch them, where they are a little bit disproportionate, I probably should make a point to start keeping them and equalizing that ecosystem. Not like I'm going to have some grand effect on a pond's population, but I don't feel bad about it when they are a little bit out of whack. So that's the first species. Chain pickerel. Second species, another species that I've written about and I've talked about because it's a fantastic little fish, and it's a native fish, and it's the fall fish. Now, the fall fish is the largest minnow species in eastern North America. They're a minnow, and they get big. Now, typically, you're going to find them in that like 6-inch range, but I've caught them 14 inches, 16 inches. I had a buddy whose kid caught one at a giant lake up here in New England that was probably a 16-incher, and just fat, big-bodied fish. And they're cool looking. I mean, they're big and scaly, and they've got kind of a blunted head. They're very unique. They're exactly what you'd think a minnow would look like if a minnow kind of grew up and hit puberty. They get all warty on their noses when it's breeding time. They get really funky looking. But they occupy most of the same streams that your trout are going to occupy. But they're also going to live in warm water streams. They're incredibly diversely ecologically found fish. And they are kind of cool to watch. If you've ever watched them do their work, they're really deliberate in the way that they build their nests and the way that they spawn. Really cool fish. Why do I like fall fish? I like fall fish because, one, they're native fish, so they're cool. They're supposed to be where they're supposed to be, where they are. And they belong in a lot of the streams on the East Coast more than smallmouth bass do. Certainly than something like brown trout does. Now, that doesn't mean that I want to kill all the brown trout and replace them with fall fish. But when you catch one, you know, and you are an advocate for conservation and you're an advocate for native fish, then that fall fish is a great thing to see. And they are a good food source for the trout when they're juveniles. They are a good predator fish that exists in these streams when they are larger. And like I was talking about with pickerel and their proportions getting out of whack, when a stream is healthy, they're going to have a healthy population of trout and a healthy population of fall fish. They exist side by side, but they occupy different niches. Why are they called fall fish, by the way? Lore has it, and I've read this a number of places, that people would find them congregated at the base of falls, the base of plunge pools. And that's true. You'll find them down there. You'll catch them. You know, you think that, oh man, this is a perfect plunge pool. This is a great spot. There's going to be a big trout hanging out at the bottom of this waterfall. And you cast a stream in there and you get a big hit and you think, ah, oh, this is nice. This thing's not jumping. It's a big, thick-bodied fish. You see it flashing around in there like, oh man, it's golden. It's like this big, mature brook trout, or maybe it's a big brown trout down there. And then you get close to you and its big, lippy mouth opens up and you realize, oh, it's a fall fish. But that is kind of going back to that quarry and culture thing I was talking about earlier. If you had a lot of fun fighting that fish, then don't balk at it. Don't fuss about it. Throw it back and keep fishing. You don't have to say, this fall fish ruined my day. And kind of like I mentioned with chain pickerel, I think a 12-inch fall fish is going to fight harder than a stocked 12-inch trout. I'm not going to say a fall fish is better than a 12-inch native trout. I'm not going to say a fall fish is better than a 12-inch trout that was stream bred. But compared to a doughy, you know, raceway rainbow trout that doesn't have a lot of color on it, a fall fish is going to fight better, and it's supposed to be there. I mean, there's a lot of ins and outs when we talk about species and where they're supposed to be and their sporting value and all that sort of stuff. But fall fish, they are supposed to be there, and they put up a good little fight. How do you fish for fall fish? Well, here's the thing. I don't think I can say that I've ever purposely fished for fall fish. They've always been bycatch. You see something rising and you cast a dry fly to it, and the thing rises and you catch it. And you realize, oh, that's not a trout, it's fall fish. You're stripping a streamer through a deep pool, and you get a strike, you pull it in, you realize, oh, that's not a trout, it's a fall fish. You're pulling a popper across some riffles on a little stream, and you think, oh, I got a smallmouth bass, you reel it in, nope, it's a fall fish. And they're just all over the place, and they're going to hit and eat everything. I've caught them on midges, I've caught them on streamers, I've caught them on poppers, I've caught them on dry flies. You name it, they're going to eat it because they are predatory fish. So there are people that fish for fall fish with a purpose, and I actually wrote an article recently simply highlighting their value as a sporting fish for some people because the Virginia state record was broken sometime in the early part of this year, and so there's an article on that on castingacross.com and why we should celebrate the guy that's fishing for these fall fish and how big these fall fish are getting, because it is the largest member of the minnow species, and this is the largest example of it that was caught in the Commonwealth of Virginia, which is pretty close to the world record or the United States record. So fall fish, not in the same category as chain pickerel in the sense that I'm not pursuing them, but when I find them, they put a smile on my face. And I will say that for both of these species, there's a lot that we can learn from them in the sense that the people that came before us, whether it be early colonists, our great-grandparents, and I would say even more pointedly, Native Americans that were catching these fish and that had a totally different relationship with them because they were quarry for them, right? Like we were talking about earlier, but their culture, their angling culture had a totally different relationship with fish than we have today. And so it's just really cool to understand and see kind of their value, how they cooked them, how they saw them as part of the ecosystem. Definitely something to read about. And there's a lot of information on there. I mean, there's a lot more information about fall fish in colonial America than brown trout in colonial America for very good reason, right? Secondly, one of the reasons I think these fish species are great is because they maintain some of that wonder, that idea that you probably don't have much anymore if you are someone who fishes a lot, where you know, I'm going to try to catch brown trout. I know I'm going to try to catch largemouth bass. But when you were a kid, you just know you're trying to catch a fish and you have no clue what's coming up. I still feel that way when I fish in some streams. I still feel that way when I fish in the ocean. Like, what am I going to catch? I know I'm probably going to catch a striper, but who knows what's going to chase my fly on any given day. And fish species like chain pickerel and fall fish, even in streams that have lots of them, they are part of a grab bag, just a myriad of species that you might catch. You might not catch them on some days, but you might catch them. And you don't know what that fish is until you see it jump or you see it close to the boat. And there's a lot of fun in that. And so those fish add to it. What do you think about chain pickerel? What do you think about fall fish? Do you hate them? Do you not like the way they make your hands smell? Do you not like the fact that they're getting in the way of your brown trout, which are supposed to be in these rivers? Well, your brown trout aren't supposed to be in these rivers. I love brown trout. I'm looking at two pictures of brown trout on my wall right now. But these fish actually have more of a right to be there than brown trout do. And so we need to kind of appreciate that. And we need to work them into our culture and work them into our quarry as well. This week on castingacross.com, the first article is called The Fly Fishing Library You Didn't Know You Had. Actually, it's The Fishing Library You Didn't Know You Had. Made the title shorter so it looked better on the internet. But this is me talking about and advocating getting your library card and getting that barcode number off the back of it. Well, I guess it's not a barcode number, the number on the barcode, and plugging that into a service called Hoopla. And Hoopla and Libby, and there's a couple other ones, they are services that get you ebooks and audiobooks, and my library gives me 5 a month, and there is a lot on there. A lot of great fly fishing books are available on there. Pretty much anything popular, you're going to be able to find on there. Some things aren't on there. I would say I probably found maybe 3 out of the 4 books I was looking for as I looked for about a dozen or 20 titles. But I mean, big name books: John Gearock, Tom Rosenbauer, Barry and Kathy Beck, Landon Mayer. A lot of these people have their published books that are on there because the publisher has a deal with Libby and the libraries and all things like that. But this is a great way, whether it be on your phone or whether it be in your tablet, to always have a fly fishing book at the ready. Or if you listen to audiobooks, then you know you're saving a couple of bucks from getting them from Audible or from another service. You get them for free. So reading books on devices is not my favorite thing. I actually really am not a huge fan of it, but that's because I really only use my little iPhone. But if you had a tablet or you had a Kindle or something like that, then those books are a great free option, and you can always have something at the ready. I do always have a book going on my phone in case I get stuck somewhere. Instead of scrolling through social media, which is by and large a waste of time, I can read a book. And so I use Hoopla. You can check out links for that and some of the books that I found with a quick cursory search over at The Fishing Library You Didn't Know You Had. Wednesday's article was called Coffee for Fly Fishing. Coffee for Fly Fishing. And this is a reworked article from 6 years ago where I tightened it up. I increased the punch of the language and decrease the volume of the language. But it's kind of a fun, lighthearted article that explores the joy, the culture that is fly fishing and how coffee is an essential part of that. So give it a read. If you don't drink coffee, I'm not sure what to tell you. I really don't understand. I consider myself a very open-minded person. I just don't have the capacity to wrap my mind around not drinking coffee, especially if you're waking up as early as you need to wake up to fish well, and you're fishing in the wintertime, and you need the energy, and I can't get it. But hey, to each his or her own, right? This week's recommendation is actually going to come on the heels of this last article, because I'm looking at my coffee mug, and the particular Yeti mug that I possess at present in front of me has a sticker on it from Nate Carnes of Remedy Provisions. And it is one of my favorite fishing related images that's ever been produced. And it is this Appalachian brook trout. And he's got a corncob pipe and he's got a hat with feather in it. And he's carrying a jug of moonshine. It's an awesome little sticker. And Remedy Provisions has countless designs. There's a Texas bass version. There's these flags of different fish species and different game birds. They're just really cool stickers. So if you want to festoon your coffee mug or your tea mug, if you're that kind of person, or your water bottle or the back of your van or whatever it is, then definitely check out the stickers from Remedy Provisions. Really cool designs. I will put a link to Remedy Provisions so you can check out the stickers and also the hats and some of the other gear that they make. I'll put a link to Remedy Provisions in the show notes of this page on castingacross.com, and you can definitely check it out. Just again, cool designs, different, out of the box, not the same stuff, you know, not some sort of a fish with a state flag, you know, plastered into it, or some you know, cute pop culture reference. Just unique, cool stuff that is, some of it's subtle, some of it's just fun, and it's definitely the kind of thing that I'm happy to have on my cooler and my water bottle and all over the place. Thanks for listening to the Casting Across Fly Fishing Podcast. Please subscribe in your favorite podcast app and then rate the podcast on iTunes. Then head over to castingacross.com for 3 posts a week on the people, places, and things that go into the pursuit of fish.
Me, Chef Jean-Paul Bourgeois, and the whole crew here at Duck Camp Dinners every Monday at 8 p.m. Eastern on Waypoint TV. Birds up in the sky.
One of the most legendary shows in the outdoors is on Waypoint TV. Don't miss Primo's Truth About Hunting, Wednesday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern on Waypoint TV, the destination for outdoor entertainment.